is Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news, intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversation. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
Good morning and welcome to Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. You know my voice, it's Levin Miller. Welcome to Monday. You may have heard the music. It's not my theme music, I know. I know what you all are thinking. Where is Levin? I'm right here and I'm in studio. But of course, if you listened to me last week, Friday, you would know that I said that I'm going to do another series. I'm doing a series. So every Monday and Friday in the month of May, and I started it off last week, Friday, thanks to Captain Anthony Allens, who will not be available during the month of May. We talked about the story that we all now know as the Flamingo. It is the day that we know or call May 10th, 1980. It is, to the minds of Bahamians, the Flamingo incident, but to the men on board that ship, it is something that has been etched in the annals of their mind. It has been etched in the hallways of history, and it's something that we as a nation must do all that we can to ensure that we never forget. And so since I'm here and I'm able to, I'm making sure that the memory that is the HMBS Flamingo, not only the fallen, we've spent 42 years and in many instances we've always recalled the fallen, but among us walk men that look like ordinary men, but there is an incident that suggests that these men were a little more than ordinary. And you heard Captain Allens' account last week about how they were all very, very young men at the time, very, very almost underage boys, almost, except for the fact that the government didn't hire underage boys. But 18 was a normal age aboard the ship. 18, 19, and Captain Allens' accounts that he was 20 at the time. And he was among some of the older on the ship. So you think about it. You think about 42 years later, where are those men? What are they doing? How has life happened to them? What has gone on since? And so I've decided that I will round them up. I've got the crew together. I'm rounding them up, and we're telling the story of what happened in the days leading up to, on the day of, and certainly in the wake of May 10th, 1980. This morning, I'm joined in the studio by now, Captain Whitfield Neely. You would have heard his name called last week, Friday. when Captain Anthony Allen said that it was him that gave the order, that someone had to go and get the men out of the water, and it was Whitfield Neely that jumped into the rubber-inflated dory, powered by about a 45-horsepower engine, and went to pick up men, right? So this morning, Captain Whitfield Neely, then Marine Seaman Whitfield Neely, is my guest, and we talk about May 10, 1980. Captain, good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning, LeVon. I am doing well.
You look well.
Doing actually.
You don't look like you survived something 42 years ago.
Boy, it was a long time ago. And good morning, Bahamas. It's a pleasure to be in all of your presence this morning.
All right. So, sir.
To have a talk with my dear old friend, LeVon.
It's good to have you, sir. It's always good to be in your company. So, sir, tell us right out of the gate, what are your decorations so that I am aware of them?
Whoa, I got to go. Okay. I'm decorated with 7 medals.
7.
It's given to me by the Defense Force and Extension, the government of the Bahamas.
Mm-hmm.
My first medal is the Medal of Gallantry.
Okay.
Then I have an inauguration medal. That's a medal that was given to persons who were present on the Defense Force when it was inaugurated.
Okay.
In 1980.
Okay.
Then I have a Distinguished Service Medal.
Okay.
Meritorious Service Medal.
Okay.
I have a Good Conduct and Long Service Medal.
Mm-hmm.
Then I have a medal that was given to me by the Bahamian government.
Okay.
It's called a MBE, or Member of the British Empire.
Okay.
And of course, I have many other accolades.
So you sound like you got more silverware than most people got in their kitchen drawer at home.
Boy, it's quite a bit.
It's a lot of silverware.
And God has been very good. God has been very good because I've had a tenure on the Defense Force that lasted almost 42 years.
And now, I don't think I heard traumatic service in that, but you should have.
I do have a traumatic service. That's the traumatic service,
yeah.
The Purple Heart.
Okay.
Yes, I do have that one.
Right.
Thank you for being so alert.
You've got a lot of silverware. Okay, so it takes, I tell people all the time, you see a man walking around with that amount of colors on, with that amount of decoration, it has to say, or it tells you a story of the life of the soldier, right? So we're talking today about the Medal of Gallantry and the Purple Heart, right?
Right. Traumatic service.
That's the one that you got for the Flamingo incident.
I got those two for the Flamingo, for the what was certain that my performances on the during the sinking of the Flamingo,
mm-hmm,
would have given me the Gallantry Medal.
Okay. Now, let's talk a little bit about that. Today, the day is May 7th, 1980. You're getting ready to go out to sea. What are you anticipating as you're about to leave harbor and sail?
LeVon, I was always an excited seaman.
Mm-hmm.
I loved going to sea. In fact, I would have graduated in February,
mm-hmm,
of that year,
okay,
1980.
Graduated high school?
No, graduated from training.
Mm.
Graduated from
new entry training.
At the police college.
Okay.
In fact, my entry, new entry 5, was the last group of individuals to train at the police college.
Okay.
And after that, Keith Mason said, well, we need to get ourselves together and develop our own training grounds, which we did for entry 6.
Okay.
But I graduated in about February because I joined in November, remember?
Okay.
November 12th.
Right.
So I was fairly new on the ground. Getting
went into training in November, passed out in February.
And on the Flamingo immediately after passing out.
Okay, assigned to the Flamingo.
In fact, we were assigned that Friday during graduation.
Okay.
We were all assigned our post. And most of us, just about everybody got ships because that's the only
thing. That was the only thing there, yeah.
We only had ships. All those Gucci positions you hear about on the Defense Force now, they didn't exist.
Okay.
They were developed by people like myself and yourself and
okay. The
ones who hit the ground for
mm-hmm.
periods of time. And so, you know, that wasn't my first trip. We had gone out to sea quite a bit.
Okay.
And we knew we were going out, and I loved going. I loved fishing. I loved the ambience of being out there, the quietness.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, I was an avid reader when I had 20/20 vision.
Okay.
So I could read in twilight
or
sunset.
Okay.
you know? But it was an exciting time, and we were always excited to be going out to sea. And then, you know, getting to know my shipmates,
yeah.
Those were the closest persons to me because just joining the job, I didn't know everybody.
And you grew up in Harbor Island.
I grew up in Harbor Island.
So you had only had a short stay in Nassau before joining the Defense Force.
I never went to school with any of those persons.
Right.
I never even knew them until I graduated and went down to Coral Harbor.
Mm.
So for me, it was a very new experience, a getting to know you experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like a fish out of the water. But
sure.
Everyone was so amicable and affable.
Mm-hmm.
They all accepted me, took me under their wings, the ones that were there prior, the former ex-Marine police.
Mm-hmm.
And Marines that were there before I arrived,
mm-hmm.
which were quite a few, they all took us under their wings. They treated us as their little brothers.
Okay.
We had an immense love on the force during that time.
Mm.
During that time, the love for each other on the Defense Force was immense.
Okay, so you're on board your ship now, headed towards Southern Bahamas. That is where you intended to go.
Yeah, but we didn't go there initially.
Okay, tell us about how did it happen.
We didn't go there initially. Initially, we were always introduced to some community in the Bahamas
mm-hmm.
by our skipper, who was then Amos Rowell. He liked to visit the communities, and you know, Eleuthera being just off there, I guess back then he had his instructions and his mission was laid out.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe he had some time, and we went up to South Eleuthera
mm-hmm.
to do some R&R.
Okay.
And get to meet people.
A little bit of tying up.
Yes, yes. Get to meet people and do some stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And we spent a night in Greencastle, Eleuthera.
Okay.
Disco 9000, big up there in Greencastle, mm-hmm. Eleuthera. I understand the disco is still going on.
Oh, yeah?
That's 40-plus years. That's a place of history there.
Okay.
And after that, we set sail
mm-hmm.
and started heading down to the southern Bahamas. We went over to the southwestern Bahamas,
mm-hmm.
which would encompass places like Anguilla, Key Sal, Key Lobos, and then we came up to the eastern side towards Ragged Island
mm-hmm.
and its string of keys down there. Beautiful islands, very beautiful islands, and the ocean itself is really lovely. And that's what we did initially.
Mm-hmm. So this would place us around May 9th.
May 9th, we started to head down around and come down around.
Pull the mic to you a little bit.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
May 9th, we started to head down
mm-hmm.
around to the southwestern Bahamas, and we come up around.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have brought us up on May 10th early in the morning. And then the afternoon, we started heading down south.
Mm-hmm.
From the Keys, mm-hmm. heading down south towards
all in what would be considered a routine patrol. Pattern.
That was routine.
Yeah.
We only worked really truly. We only worked the southern Bahamas.
Okay, so the chase is on now. You've been sailing for 2 days,
mm-hmm.
and mind you could sail for 15 days and see nothing.
Oh yeah,
right.
Oh,
but
yeah. 28 actually.
Day number two, you get out there and it's go time.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Cuban vessels spotted. What exactly is the mood?
That afternoon, we saw some smoke.
Mm-hmm.
And then as we got closer, you know, these fearsome fishing vessels, they're made from some kind of material, something like a concrete.
Mm-hmm.
But it floats, believe it or not, it floats.
Yeah.
And we saw two of them on the northwestern side of Key Santo Domingo with our approach heading south.
Mm-hmm.
And the skipper said, make ready. We're going to go over and see what they're doing because it's obvious they're fishing in our waters.
Mm-hmm.
And those would have not been our first arrest. Even though I had just joined the force, I had made arrests before with these same type vessels.
Mm-hmm.
So, and having some experience coming from the island, like you alluded to a little earlier, having some experience with operating small craft, because in Harbor Island, I was very fortunate. I only hung out with older people, so every time I went out with the older men in their boats, they had taught me how to use them and handle them.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to drive boats. So the skipper realized that, so he made me a seaboat captain. That's what he called me. I'll be a seaboat captain. Well, of course, being the most junior person, that took some discussion.
yeah.
You know, because you just can't.
No, that's a big rank.
Yeah, you can't overstep
person's junior. Seaboat captain. Decision. You mean the junior man? Could never happen.
But those Nassau landlubbers, they didn't. So I was able to get in there and do my part. And when I did it, he was happy with my performance. So I got the job and I was dubbed the seaboat captain. And you know, when they say seaboat's away,
mm-hmm.
the seaboat skipper, he has to be in the mm-hmm. boat. He mm-hmm. let you down in the water.
Mm-hmm.
and then you embark whoever you're taking with you to whatever the mission is.
Right. So that would be comprised of yourself as the handler.
Right.
The boarding officer.
Right.
And then two members of a search party.
Right. But okay. We had two vessels.
Okay.
But before that, though, the vessels were not easy to intercept.
Okay.
Because the Cuban fishermen determined, because they knew what the outcome would be if mm-hmm. we caught them.
Mm-hmm.
Their country would be embarrassed. They would be embarrassed. They'll be down there on Bay Street being paraded, mm-hmm. and then they'll have to pay a fine and for the fishermen and also pay a fine to get their boat back.
Right.
So they tried to make a run for it. And of course, Captain Amos Rowe was a very assertive kind of an individual.
Mm-hmm.
If he had his mind made up or if he made a statement, you don't contravene that, because he was the skipper of all skippers. I learned a lot from him.
Mm-hmm.
I learned a lot from him. He was really a on-point individual. Never allowed meandering or foolishness to happen, especially if he was working. So when he saw the boats making way, we couldn't stop them. They were doing 6 knots, but the Flamingo was a boat just over 100 feet. Mm-hmm. We couldn't just get in their way and stop them.
Right.
So he got our gunner, Tucker, and told him, shoot out the engine in the first one. Of course, the weapon was already loaded, because every time we went down south, we kept our weapon loaded.
Right.
We had to use it. So Tucker strapped in, and boom, 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 hit the engine in the first one, the lead one, and it stopped it.
And that in itself is an interesting evolution to have happen, because you're talking about a floating platform.
Right.
You're not on the ground.
No.
A man strapped into, what was it, a 20 cal?
What's 20, that? 20 millimeter.
20 millimeter.
Yeah.
And you're talking about him having to actually...
He was a good gunner.
I
was impressed.
Land shots on a moving vessel, at a moving vessel.
And hit it.
And not kill people.
But remember the instructions by the skipper.
Right.
Stop it.
Stop the vessel.
He had no choice. He had to stop it.
Yeah.
The skipper says stop it.
Right.
You stop
so
it.
He opens fire. We've got one vessel stopped.
One stopped, and then the second one stopped.
Volunteered to stop.
The second one had to stop because, see, they couldn't just go back to Cuba, I think, and say, boy, we had to leave that set out there because we were under fire from the Royal Bahamas Defense Force. So mm-hmm. they stopped. I think they really stopped to see if they could have assisted in getting them on board to continue making a run, but that didn't happen because by the time Tucker stopped the vessel, the sea boat was in the water with the arresting officers mm-hmm. and myself.
Okay.
And we went over, embarked both vessels, because there were about 7 of us, but mm-hmm. 3 on each boat.
Mm-hmm.
And we embarked the vessels, did a preliminary inspection of both vessels and determined that they were in the Bahamas fishing because they had fishery products. And we read them their Miranda rights mm-hmm. and arrested them.
Mm-hmm.
We arrested them. And I don't know if you want me to continue.
Well, I'm trying to figure out, when did you know, the arrest took place, when did you know that something was a bit different or something was going to be a bit different about
while
this
we were making the arrest? Right. Okay. Working down south,
mm-hmm.
back then, the Cold War was still ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
You had the Cubans aligned with Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we were aligned with the Americans,
right.
And seeing Cuban aircraft down south
mm-hmm.
was a normal occurrence.
Okay.
That wasn't the
So
first
it didn't
time.
Shake you that you saw planes originally?
No, it didn't.
Okay.
Initially, we expected to see them because they kind of...
kept the area hot.
And not only that, remember their borders are only 20-something miles down to the west.
Right. As a matter of fact, that is something that we still have a bit of negotiations going on with.
But we have a more amicable relationship with the Cubans, and we talk to each other now, which is good.
Right.
But the Cubans always patrol their borders
mm-hmm.
because America is just off to the northwest,
mm-hmm.
and we're over on the east side.
Right.
So they are always...
In the line there?
Yeah, flying around. And they used Russian aircraft to do that because Cuba didn't make aircraft.
Okay.
But whatever aircraft they used came from Russia. And these aircraft were MiG-25 aircraft.
Mm.
We Google it. But I looked in the Collier encyclopedia and knew what it was.
Right.
So I realized what it was. But these aircraft showed up when we started our preparation to embark and get back out to start heading back up north to deposit these vessels over maybe under Ragged Island
mm-hmm.
and have the police deal with it. Because I think that's what the original discussion
intention was
on board. But back then, I was never one to be.
Yeah, and you're a very junior man. Junior. Very junior man. Kind of. As a matter of fact, were you the most junior person on the vessel?
My squad mates and I, there were four of us that joined the ship.
Okay.
Anthony Russell, Edward Williams, Leo Kirby, Whitfield Neely. No, five of us. And the cook, Willard Sanders. Willard, my apologies.
Okay.
Love you, buddy. And we were the most junior persons on the Defense Force at the time. Mm-hmm. There were five of us earmarked to be on the HMBS Flamingo.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And we were never in those kind of conversations.
Right. So you had no clue what was happening there.
They didn't talk to us.
You didn't know what the intention was.
No.
Your job here is muscle.
Yeah, they didn't talk to us unless something was
broken.
How
old were you?
I was 21.
21. So unlike Captain Allens, who we interview, he would have been the executive officer.
Yeah.
He said he was 20.
Yeah, he was an officer. He would have trained at Dartmouth.
Right. So he would have had a better understanding as to what was the intention of the patrol after the arrest.
Right. I was just brawn.
Right. You was just muscle.
Do this, do that.
Correct.
And go back, sit down until something else broke or need to be done.
Correct. So sir, you have the incident where you are with the boarding party.
Right.
Flamingo comes under attack. You must be watching that from arm's length away.
I had a very vivid view of the entire incident. Mm-hmm. But like I told you, you asked me how did I know something was not mm-hmm. going.
When did you know that this was different?
When these aircraft showed up, they were very aggressive. They were usually when you saw the aircraft, they were like a couple thousand feet up in the air, and they'll just be flying over,
mm-hmm.
casually flying over.
Mm-hmm.
But when the aircraft showed up, there were two of them.
Okay.
I saw it. There were two aircraft. One engaged the Flamingo because there was a valley. Well, the Flamingo was off to the west of the vessels that we arrested.
Mm-hmm.
And this aircraft was flying just about surface level.
Mm.
And let me tell you, Lamont, that day, the water was like that wall that's there just behind you, the blue wall.
Mm-hmm.
That's how calm it was.
Flat
there was
calm.
Not a ripple. Oil, like oil in a barrel,
mm-hmm.
smooth and shiny. And that aircraft came down a couple times between the Flamingo and the captured craft. I saw the captain.
Mm-hmm.
I looked him in his eye. That's how close he came down and how low he was flying.
Mm-hmm.
And he was flying very aggressively. When he flew, the water sprayed up. And he just, of course, you don't hear him.
Mm-hmm.
Because those aircraft travel faster than the speed of sound.
Right.
So you have to see him. And I saw him about twice. He made a pass. And then you hear a big roar. Boom. And he's gone.
Right.
And then he's gone and he's shooting up into the sun because the sun was setting in the west. And then he's getting back around because that's how they're trained to get into the sun so you can't be seen. Mm-hmm. And someone's going to shoot at you.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because I guess he wasn't sure what we had on our vessel.
But you were no match.
No, definitely not. We only had the 20 millimeter and some submachine guns and some SLRs.
Yeah, Jesus of the Savior at that
point. Yeah, only Jesus could have saved us.
Yeah, okay. So
and
so tell us about the instance when you realized the Flamingo was hit.
That was much later than when we first were engaged by the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, when the captain saw that, when Amos Roll, I like to call his name, his soul rest in peace.
Mm-hmm.
When our skipper saw that this aircraft was so assertive, aggressive, he said, hey, I saw when they started hoisting mm-hmm. other flags on the Flamingo.
Right.
So that the aircraft will surely get an indication
that this is a naval ship.
We were,
mm-hmm.
that we're a Bahamian naval ship.
Mm-hmm.
We hoist extra jacks, extra ensigns, and all the colors we had on board were flying.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was flying. And then the skipper started to get a little, on the radio, he started to become a little excited. He said, okay, we got to get out of here. I don't like how this aircraft flying around and coming so close.
Mm-hmm.
And we started to prepare both vessels to be towed to get out of the area and start mm-hmm. heading back north towards Ragged Island. Because we were down on Key Santo Domingo, the vessels were arrested on the southeast side of the key, mind you. We mm-hmm. saw them on the southwest. Remember, I told you they were moving.
Mm-hmm.
And we arrested them on the southwestern side because they were heading west.
Okay.
Right? And while we were preparing, we got all the vessels tied up. And the captain said to Captain Amos Rule. Captain Amos Rule said to Captain Anthony Allen, mm-hmm. now Captain.
Now Captain. Then sub-lieutenant.
Sub-lieutenant.
Yeah.
that don't send the seaboat back. Let the seaboat stay over there with y'all. We got to get out of here. So the boat that was running, I tied my vessel, my seaboat up behind that, and I was on the deck.
Okay.
Right? We tied both vessels up behind the Flamingo, and then we started heading north in a slow, at a slow speed.
Right.
Because towing two vessels, you know, you're right, not going to go fast. Okay? And when we initially started out, the aircraft came back. The aircraft came out of the northeast. I saw it. And then it came down to the surface, mm-hmm, swung across the starboard bow of the Flamingo. While it was swinging, disengaged its 20-millimeter guns. I said, oh, my God. I thought he hit the Flamingo then, but mm-hmm, he didn't. I said, but that's strange. I've never seen that. This mm-hmm isn't shaping up to be good. This mm-hmm can be a long day, a long evening. Mm-hmm. And then the aircraft disappeared. So we continued on our way, heading north, trying to get up to Ragged Island. Mm-hmm. But of course, we only had so much speed we can do. And you could not run the aircraft.
10 knots is what the Flamingo was doing at top speed, eh?
Well, no, we had more speed than that if we weren't towing.
Okay.
But we were towing, so we were really under 10 knots. And we were sitting there. After a while, we became relaxed. But because initially, we were all amazed, and I was terrified. I'm going to be honest with mm-hmm you. That's the first time in my life I've ever seen a plane discharge a weapon. And it really wasn't a nice thing to see or to be on the receiving end of. Mm-hmm. I said, boy, this is crazy. This is what I applied for. Come out of the hotel and this is where I am. So we were sitting there talking. We engaged in conversation. And we were talking. And then I heard this sound like a siren. And I looked around, I say, siren, this sound like fire truck or ambulance coming down by Mortimer Candy Kitchen on East Street Hill. Because I lived on East Street, so I often heard siren. Mm-hmm. I said, boy, but shouldn't be no fire truck out here. I see no emergency or nothing. Then it dawned on me, boy, you're underwater, no mm-hmm fire truck, there's something else. Mm-hmm. Then I heard the explosions.
Mm.
I said, what? And I looked around, and I looked in front of me, and the Flamingo was shaking.
Mm.
And smoking.
You were on the captured craft.
I was on the captured craft. Mm-hmm. I was able to see all of this. Mm-hmm. And everything stopped. Then I said, what's going on? Because this is the first time I'm ever seeing anything like right this. You see what I'm saying? In the real. Of course, mm-hmm, you see it in movies and stuff. And then I said, but the Flamingo has holes in it. And she's just staying there smoking and shaking. And I sat there for a few seconds trying to really gain in my mind what was happening. And then I saw everybody started screaming and running mm-hmm and shouting over on the Flamingo. Because the Flamingo stopped, we actually drifted up close on the Flamingo because remember now, they were towing us.
Right.
And the cable length and the ropes, maybe three cables when you're towing a vessel. So it's not very far away. Mm-hmm. And when the Flamingo stopped, we still had our propulsion from being towed, so we kind of went close up under the Flamingo. And then I saw my shipmates looking all terrified, everybody, eyes and face all aghast.
Paled with fear.
And eyes wide like teacups, everybody running around. And I was afraid. Mm-hmm. I said, boy, this is not normal. And then I realized we were under attack. Mm. The Cuban aircraft had attacked us. Sent down some air-to-surface missiles and hit the Flamingo three times. Right where the smokestack was on the starboard side, it mm-hmm hit it there. Then it hit it in the mid, just below the midship line. And then it hit it again on the stern, on the starboard side, mm, in the starboard quarter. And those were gaping holes like 3 feet wide.
Mm. Into a steel hull?
Into a steel hull.
Wow.
In that split second. Then, of course, it wasn't blowing a lot of air during that, a lot of wind during that time, so all of the smoke and scent from all of the explosion started to filter through the air, and I was able to smell it and see it. And it was a lot of smoke. And then my shipmates all started getting in a frenzy, and running up and down. And then the aircraft came back using the machine gun. You see?
By this time, are people in the water?
Yes, by then, because a flamingo caught a fire.
Okay. So the metal hull, I imagine, begins to get hot now because of the fire.
Of course. I would have thought it was getting hot, and then people were terrified.
Right. So the order is given to abandon ship. Men are overboard, and now they come back with machine gun fire.
Right. The explosions would have left everybody mentally disenfranchised, I'm sure, that were on the ship, because they were loud. They were very loud. And I saw people jumping in the water.
Now, Captain Allen tells a story about having to give the instruction to get into the sea boat. I tell people all the time, an instruction is easy to give if you have somebody on the complying end.
Yes. But, you know,
what's going on in the mind of Whitfield Neely when he's given the instruction by his executive order to get into the dory and go over there and get the men?
Lamont, I like to include this little statement before I say what was going on in my mind.
Sure.
If you look at the battlefield...
Pull the mic to you a little bit more.
Oh, man. If you look at the battlefield, Lamont, there are no old men on the battlefield.
No, they're all young men.
Old men don't fight battles. Okay?
Yes, sir.
If you send two opposing forces on the battlefield and they're all old men, they're going to be drinking wine, playing dominoes, and talking some old
story. At sunset.
There's not going to be any fighting. Okay?
Yes, sir.
So, when he said that somebody has to go... I would have thought one of the senior guys was going to say, boy, let me go. I got to do this. But I heard someone comment, man, I'm married. I can't go out there. Because I fell in on the plane shooting a machine gun and I can get killed. And then I say, but those are my shipmates. I got to get out there. Remember, I was only 21.
Right.
I had no wife, no children. I didn't even have a car to care about the tires.
Just young and steely.
Yeah, young and silly. So... I jumped in the sea boat and I went out. When I went out, the first persons I saw, I started collecting.
Do you remember who were among the people that you picked up?
I picked up a couple fellas. I could remember I picked up Willard, I picked up Greg. I picked up some other guys, you know, and I brought them back to the sea boat. I went out, picked up some more, brought them back in. Because where everyone was in such a panic, swimming was not their best forte at the time. Because I don't know, if your brain disengages, people don't understand.
Right.
I always tell people, panic causes people to die.
Correct.
Stay calm and assertive. Do what you're supposed to do. Do your job. Don't panic.
Right. Machine gun fire in a rubber vessel, though, sir. How are you? How are you maintaining composure?
I'm not thinking that I'm going to be hit. I don't know that. I always have this thought.
45 horsepower rubber vessel.
Yeah, when it's over, I'm going to be there to talk about it. I always had that thought when I was on the defense force, you know. Because, you know, I had some close calls.
Right.
And I always say, well, I'm going to get home.
Yeah.
But I got to make sure everybody else gets home with me.
Mm-hmm.
And after I picked up everybody, I thought I picked up everybody. I looked off in the distance when we went back. We were, trying to do our stuff and get ourselves together. And I looked off in the distance and I saw a fire extinguisher being used. I said, oh God, the captain's still over there with a fire extinguisher. So I jumped back in the seaboard and went out there and retrieved him. Of course, I had encouraged him to let's go because, boy, I don't know. I never had to abandon any of my vessels, but I don't think it's a good feeling.
So the captain was still on board trying to save his ship.
Yeah, he was using an extinguisher on the bridge of the ship because the ship was full of fire and flames all over the place. And he was trying to put one out, I guess, to say he can do his part to keep the vessel afloat. But then I told him, because by then the flamingo was starting to descend into the abyss stern first. Because, you know, that's where the engines are on the stern. And the weight from those engines was starting to take it down.
Right.
And because of the holes in the vessel, there was she was filling up with the ocean. So I went over close. I said, sir, you got to come. The boat's sinking. You got nothing you could do. We got to go. We got to get out of here. We got the one boat that's running. We're over there, and you're the only one. We're waiting on you. We got to go. And he finally realized what I was saying was making sense. So he jumped into the water, and I assisted him in getting into my sea boat. And we went back to where I had deposited all the other persons. Because by then we had gotten all the other persons off the sea boat, the fishing boat that wasn't running. And everybody was on the one that was running. Along with the fishermen, the Cuban fishermen. because they were with us the entire while and they were afraid.
Right.
Okay. And when Captain Roll got back, he was always in charge. He never lost his focus of who he was.
Didn't lose composure.
No, he never did. Never did. He was a strong leader.
Mm.
Good man. And he then said to everybody, you know, we got to get together. We started to do a head check, head count, and came up four short.
Mm.
I said, Jesus.
By this time, sun is almost set.
Well, the sun is setting. Mm-hmm. It's really down now,
mm-hmm.
just like after five going into six.
Mm-hmm.
And we realized that there are four of our shipmates missing, and we identified who they were. Then I had to go back out.
Mm-hmm.
And mind you, the Cuban aircraft are still around flying. I had to go back out and look. And of course, I went alone. Nobody come with me.
Mm-hmm.
Drive the boat around, looking, looking, looking. And it was so calm if someone was swimming.
You should have seen ahead.
I could have seen them. And then I said, well, let me go over to the boat and start shouting out their names. When I was there shouting out their names, man, that silence almost drove me crazy. Nothing. No sound. Just no waves or nothing. Just calm.
A sinking ship.
Just the only thing you could see is the ship sinking. I said, boy, this ain't good. So I looked and I went around and looked again. And I had to make a decision because, you know, the sun was going down
right.
and the ship was sinking. I told them, I don't see anyone else. Then everybody started calling names and trying to see if we can get a return on the shouting that we were doing, and there was no return, no answer. So quickly I realized those guys were not coming back.
What does it feel like when you realize that people that you ate breakfast with that morning,
I just finished training with Williams.
Yeah.
We used to walk home in the evening sometimes when we had short leave because he lived Lewis Street.
Right.
I lived Lily of the Valley Corner.
But you realize in the head count that four of them are no more. Where is your, is this in your mind the day that you realize, boy, maybe I should have taken that job in the hotel after all?
I had the job in the hotel. I took a pay cut of 66%
right.
to join the defense force.
Okay.
Because I was a front desk clerk. And of course, back then, boy, tips were good.
Mm.
But I had a good salary.
Mm.
And the defense force salary made me a pauper.
You watched the nose of the flamingo go into the into what we know as Davy Jones's locker. What does that feel like for you?
Initially, before the flamingo sank, like I told you, mm-hmm. Commander Amos Roll took charge of the scenario. He got us all, you know, of course we are military, we lined up, and he said we have to salute the flamingo because he then, I guess, he realized that the ship was lost.
Yeah.
He said, let's salute her. And then we'll say a prayer for the missing men and for the flamingo.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we did. I think, was it Peter St. James, I think, prayed?
Mm.
I think it was Peter St. James. I'll have to confirm with him.
Okay.
And, you know, we said a prayer, then we all saluted. And then as the sun was going down, believe it or not, LaVon, the flamingo bow slipped silently and graciously below the surface of the water.
Mm.
And we never saw the flamingo again.
Mm.
Some debris floated up, but that was it.
Mm.
We didn't have time to even collect any of the debris that floated up because we now
had to get out of there.
We had to get out of there because the aircraft was flying and Captain Amos Roll, he took charge. He said, come on guys, now we gotta make our way. We only have this one boat, everybody on board, we confirmed. We had the six Cuban fishermen, and we all started heading north in that boat. And that's what we did. We headed north.
Now, you got to, Captain Allen tells a story about how he believed they created smokers in that instance because you all had to.
We did.
Yeah.
We did. See, the aircraft didn't only stay with us during the attack, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They went, and they came back with helicopters with bright lights hanging off them, looking for us.
Mm-hmm.
I think they realized that we hadn't got the message out that we were attacked. I don't know what their plans was. I can hypothesize or assume, which is not good when you're spinning a story.
Sure.
But I think they realized that we were the only ones that knew the flamingo was now sunk. and who did it.
Right.
So they came back that night with a vengeance. And they had that ocean lit right up.
Mm.
Because remember, the sun went down when the flamingo sank. So we were heading north in the dark.
Right.
And then the ocean is dark in the night. You've been out there.
Yeah.
Nighttime, there's no light out there.
Yeah. You call it the pitch black dark of night.
Pitch black dark of night. And we saw them hovering about, going around. And for some reason, man, Lavon, I felt the presence of God on us. God kept us. And we didn't turn on any lights. We didn't make any sounds. We were quiet. And I could vividly remember people like Oscar Maynard Miller smoking cigarettes under the barrette, smoking the cigarettes and keeping the lit cigarette under his barrette so we can see on
the compass
which direction we were heading in, because we had a heading, because, you know, Captain Amrul and Anthony Allens and those boys, they know how to navigate. So we weren't lost.
Right.
We knew where we were heading. And we kept doing that the entire time, all the way up to Ragged Island. And those aircraft kept looking for us, and for some reason, they couldn't see us. I really concluded in my mind, I have to Google it. I have to find out what kind of substance these fishing boats were made from. I don't think they gave a good echo
for
on
the radar.
I don't think so. It's like the Haitian boats in the nights when we're out there.
Yeah, the radars don't see them.
The radars can't pick them up. Yeah. People think it's easy, but the radars can't pick them up. So we were not spotted because they couldn't get an image on their radar as to where we were.
You get onto Ragged Island.
Yes.
The chase doesn't stop, though.
No, it doesn't. It continues.
What happens onto Ragged Island?
It continues into the other day, into that Sunday, which was Mother's Day. My Lord. My mommy must have been failing in her health during that time. And we got ashore in the early hours of the morning. We ran the boat up until it stopped. And we walked into the water and walked up to Duncan Town, Ragged Island. That's the name of the town there. And we realized, nobody knew.
Right.
Only us and God and the Cubans knew that the flamingo was sunk.
Mm.
Because I realized then, we didn't get a message off.
Okay.
When that aircraft hit Flamingo initially,
it took out comms.
Those guys were trained to do what they had to do.
Mm-hmm.
They knew the Flamingo because, you know, the Jane's defense warship books got all these every military vessel and aircraft is in that book. And you can just Google it and pull it out nowadays.
So you get on to Ragged Island, and the Cubans come on to Ragged Island.
They don't come then.
Okay.
They don't come then because we got away, remember? They were looking for us. So they were still out there on the ocean, circling around, trying to see if they can find us. They didn't find us. So we got away from the net that they laid out. We slipped through it, and we got to Ragged Island. And like I said, I realized there was no message sent out that the flamingo was under attack because everyone was sleeping comfortably. We walked straight up through the town. Everybody sleep because there was nothing to worry about.
Right.
Persons didn't worry about things when they were sleeping in settlements throughout the Bahamas back then.
You wake up the settlement of Ragged Island on Mother's Day.
We woke them up. We didn't only wake them up. We woke up the police who was really engaged in getting a good nap.
Right.
And he looked up at us, and then it didn't dawn on him.
Right.
But then he got his composure quickly, and he realized that, boy, this Captain Roll and his crew, because that wasn't the first time
he went to Duncan Down. Right.
No, we went there often.
Right.
In my short tenure, we went there quite a few times. And then Captain Roll said to him what had happened.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, Captain Roll is a take charge kind of fella, and he's calling you laddie.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't got no rank like him, you're laddie, right?
Yeah.
Laddie, you got to get up. We got to do this. We got to do that. We got to do this. I want this done. I want this done.
And this
done.
Is the officer in charge of Ragged Island.
He was in charge until Amos arrived.
Yeah.
And then he
Amos took charge.
Oh, yeah. He took charge.
Mm-hmm.
And he told him, we got to get some calls out. We got to get this information out. And that's when everything started to happen. Of course, the information went to New Providence, and then I don't know what happened here in New Providence.
Right.
But we sat around that morning. The people in Duncan Town, they took good care of us. One or two of my shipmates were injured. They kind
of... Some of them shot?
Yeah, we had two persons.
Okay, shot.
Call
their
name.
Okay.
They had some bullet wounds on them.
Okay.
The nurse there and the persons there helped doctor them up. Some of us needed clothing.
They because gave, all of your effects had sunk.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Everything sunk. Mm-hmm. They gave some of us clothing, and of course, they prepared meals for us because by then it was coming nigh to breakfast time. Mm. We were hungry. We hadn't eaten from that evening,
right.
Really lunchtime, because we didn't have our dinner.
Right.
Because we were engaged with arresting the two Cuban fishing boats. So they fed us, and they took very good care of us. They're like really loving, kind people down there in Duncan Town.
We've got about 7 minutes left, Skipper. You get into New Providence. The time flies by quickly. You get into New Providence. What is the mood in Nassau when you get here?
You know, I was watching a radio station this morning, a Bahamian radio station. Mm. I felt good.
Mm.
I felt very good because they were talking about some young people who are casting good exploits over there in the continental United States of America with sports. Then
mm-hmm.
I looked at the setting on the TV. The two young persons, they were really professional. Mm. And I said, boy, all that sacrifice I made was worth it.
Yeah.
Because this is a wonderful country and God has blessed us and we're doing great things. You understand what I'm saying? And the mood here in 1980, May 10th, was a mood of what I call the only coming together of the Bahamian populace I've ever experienced in my 60 plus years.
Mm.
Everyone wanted to go and attack Cuba.
Mm.
We didn't have a gun. Cuba was a real military
yeah,
might.
Yeah, yeah.
Cuba was a military yeah, might yeah. on the global scene.
Yeah.
And we didn't have a gun.
But there was a galvanizing of the Bahamian people.
The galvanizing of the Bahamian people happened. We all were on one accord.
Mm-hmm.
We all acted and said the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
That Cuba was in error. They attacked us. They killed four of our boys. We gotta go get them. Gotta go get
now,
them.
Now, you were a Marine seaman, one of the more junior men on board the ship. Captain Allen's accounts that he and Commander Amos Rowell had to go and give account for the government ship.
Yes, they would have had to go.
You, as a Marine seaman, though, would have had a completely different fate. What exactly did you get into the deal?
I had
after?
To write a report.
Mm-hmm.
I had to write a report as to what I thought transpired.
Mm-hmm.
And questions were asked by senior Defense Force persons of us,
mm-hmm.
which I had to answer. And it was a continuous thing,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Do you ever feel to yourself, though, like, man, report, mister, they just were shooting at me. And right now, I won't go see my ma.
No, you can't do that in the military. And that's what these kids don't understand. In the military, you can't do that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You have to follow instructions.
Mm-hmm.
I did that for 42 years.
Yeah.
I followed instructions.
Even when the instruction is get into a rubber inflated vessel and,
yes,
and go take people out of the water under active gunfire.
That's where your discipline kicks in. Mm-hmm.
I told the story, sir. Sorry, I told the story on the weekend as I'm working into the series, and someone said, well, they could never have been no Whitfield Neely, because when Captain Allen tell him, son, get in the boat, he say, not today, chief.
No, you had to go. And then, you know, you would have had that I'm love mm-hmm. for your shipmate.
It's instinctive. You just do it.
Yeah, you have to do it. You can't just sit there. What if you did? What if I didn't move?
Yeah. More men would be dead.
Thank you.
All of the men may have been dead.
And then I find myself often wishing I had moved earlier.
Mm-hmm.
You see, and I keep saying I maybe would have found the four that were missing.
Mm.
You understand what I'm saying? Because nobody has a real precise
firm account as to what happened
as to how they met their death.
Yeah.
Because by now we got to realize they're dead.
Yeah.
And we got to move on. But
42 years later, sir, in the final 3 minutes of the show, 42 years later, do you ever look back at it and say to yourself, I wish they had done more to commemorate the Flamingo? 42 years later, you're telling the story. And as I can see from my text line, people are sitting here and oh, never heard the story before. How does that translate in your mind?
I'll tell you. The Bahamas had become independent July 10th, 1973.
Mm-hmm.
This was May 10th, 1980.
Yeah, so we had about 6 years and some change as a country.
Thank you very much. Yeah. 6 years, 10 months, something like that.
Right. The Royal Bahamas Defense Force had only been inaugurated for about 18 months at the time. Six months at the time.
No, 1980. Don't forget.
The inauguration was after this?
Yeah.
So you hadn't even been inaugurated?
No, it was just before this.
Right, March.
That's why I got
March
a medal.
March 30th, yes.
That's why I got a medal for the March inauguration, 30th. Remember?
Right. And this is 2 months after its inauguration.
Yes, yes.
And about 6 months after you're out of training.
Of course, the Defense Force was activated.
Right, 79.
Yeah. Couple of years before this, right, with the Marine Police.
Right, but you all had only just been officially dubbed the Royal Bombers Defense Force in March 1980.
Around then,
and then May 10th, you had the active gunfire from the Cuban.
Exactly. And, you know, I often say to myself, boy, I could have been what I wanted to be. I thought I had a good brain. Mm-hmm. But, of course, my economics at the time were not lining up with going to university and all of that. Because I came from Harbor Island. For our family, and if I had to do it again, Levon, I'll do it exactly the way I did it. Wow. I've never, and I don't think anyone has had a more grander time working a job for 42 years. The Royal Bahamas Defense Force, I will say, was the highlight of my life.
Wow.
And I will not step away, and I will not take another offer. If I was born 1959, get back to New Providence, get my first job.
You'd still go down the line that takes you to becoming Captain Whitfield Ely.
I would. I've lived and I've engaged in some of the grander times. Prisons with money have not had a nicer time than I've had.
Thank you very much for coming, Cap. We appreciate you.
Captain
Whitfield Ely has been my guest. You heard him. He's got more silverware than most people got in their kitchen drawer at home.
Thank you very much.
He's still loving the Lantry Medal. A Purple Heart, Traumatic Service Medal, Inauguration Medal, and some that's too much to mention. Meritorious and distinguished. Anyway, that's my show. That's my time.
Thank you,
Lee Van Miller. This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM, your station for fresh news and smart talk. So don't move. News is now.